Pet Session number 10657, Reel 12.
Major Lewis, Reel 12. You were describing the scene where the battalion column reached the final objective.
That's it.
Confusion everywhere.
Yes. A confused appearance with both sides firing tracer in all directions without much apparent result. Well, at this stage, to the effect of a large-scale fireworks display, the RAF appeared on the scene, dropped a large number of flares to try and find out what was going on, and then proceeded systematically to bomb both us and the Germans. But fortunately, without doing any damage to our column.
First time you'd seen direct support from the Air Force?
Yes. Yes, we didn't see anything over Gazala. Yes, it would be. Mm. Yep. Right, the the battalion column, that's the 8th Battalion column, waited on the final objective until ordered to by brigade to return to its original positions outside Matru, and the trucks formed up facing north. The return journey was much quieter, despite the fact that the whole battalion passed right through the centre of an Italian lager. The lagers, similar to ours, being circular affairs, rather like the old covered wagon days. So you just went in one side and out the other. It was reminiscent of the old Red Indian days. As the vehicles accelerated and drove through the groups of Italian lorries and bivouacs, passengers sitting next to the drivers propped rifles and Bren guns on the truck doors and fired into the lager, and also tossed the odd grenade out as well as they went by. The column soon broke clear and sped on, and as it sped on, the shouting of the Italians grew fainter. The battalion reached its original positions on the telegraph lines just as day was breaking. Although the attack by the two divisions, that's 5 Indian and 50 Div, had obviously caused a lot of confusion in the enemy lines of communication, there were many in the 8th Battalion who felt that the operation had disorganized the British forces as much as it had the Germans, for it had not been carried out without casualties, and trucks and men were missing when a count was taken just after daybreak. However, the worst part of the Battle of Merseytru was yet to come.
Do you remember what happened to B Company? You know, what sort of losses they had?
Very, very light. Very light losses. I can't remember that we had any considerable losses at all that night, actually. Certainly Ian Pitt, he was all right. He was the company commander. And the other platoon commander, Bullpin, came through that one all right as well as I did. So
this time then, you'd only got 3 officers in the company.
Yes, well, company commander, second in command. There should have been a company commander, second in command, and 3 platoon commanders. But you didn't often get a company as full as that. It doesn't look to me as though Ian Pitt had a second in command then either. I think he probably was the company commander, and there were probably 2 or 3 platoon commanders. If there wasn't a platoon commander, then a sergeant ran the platoon. That's about it, I think.
What was your role actually on this sort of motorised attack? I mean, it's quite clear what you were doing when you were going out on a patrol from Gaza. Mm. Like that. if you were involved in a raid like this, did you have a distinct personal role?
Well, it rather depended. I mean, you might have been sitting in the passenger seat of a 3-ton lorry. Or you might have been standing up in the front of a Bedford truck or something like that. But wherever you were, you were known before you started off to members of your platoon or your company. But in a situation like this, the main object of the exercise being to keep moving and to shoot up anything that we came across on the move, really was every man and every truck for himself. You know, I mean, there was no leadership you could give in a case like this, apart from the truck right up at the front, maybe with the company commander in. But then I think, it wasn't like a platoon advancing or a company advancing. There was no lateral communication or any sort of communication. I mean, there wasn't any signal given. If we fire a red very light, it means we're approaching a lager. You had to watch out for everything yourself. And if you were back a little bit, you would see that there was a lot of firing going on in front of you, which would imply that the leading trucks in the column were going through, and you knew that you were going through shortly afterwards. And it was purely and simply a question of shooting out the sides all the time whenever you went through any inhabited area, as it were. It was quite unlike any sort of army tactic. There's nothing like it in a textbook. It doesn't exist anywhere. Because they were all soft-skinned vehicles. It doesn't even say there that we had the carriers with us. And we may well not have done, you know. They're not very... I mean, they can be a bit blind at night, brain carriers, especially if you've got slit trenches and things. And it could... I'm almost certain that that was a soft-skin vehicle operation.
Were you in charge of a particular column of the...
Only of your own platoon.
Of your own platoon.
Yes, I mean, that's 30 men odd. I suppose they'd be broken down into about 3 three-tonners, something like that. So a company would have about 9 three-tonners. You know, they can carry more than that, but you wouldn't have carried more than that on an operation like that, I don't think. You know, they were sort of, where it was possible, the awnings were rolled up at the side and that, you know, and so that they could actually fire over the edges. And as you went through a sort of, if you spotted a bivouac or something, you simply took a 36 grenade with 4-second fuse on it and lobbed it out. And by the time it went off, you were quite a long way away. And with a bit of luck, it might have gone down into the slit trench.
So what you're saying would appear there weren't any drills or tactics worked out with this at all?
No, it was purely to follow the main body of trucks in that direction. We had to know how far we were going, that was important, and then to turn round and set the column up again, as it was, with probably its four lines like that, and then off you went again and back.
So the orders then would really consist of the RVs?
The orders would mainly have been to make absolutely certain that we knew how far we got to go, and that after that period of time we should be thinking and watching for somebody to set us up again to come back, which would have been done. But it was a very confused situation, actually. I mean, there was firing going on all over the place, left, right and centre, and you didn't really know where it was coming from, some of it. I think that the enemy were just as almost as well more confused than we were, in actual fact.
Presumably
because they were taken by surprise.
Because they wouldn't have known what was going on.
No,
at
quite.
All, would they?
Quite. Or what the extent of it was. But I think an intelligent enemy might have thought to themselves, well, there's not been any gunfire preceding this, so this is only a strong patrol or something. But they didn't get around to thinking that, and they certainly didn't bring anything to bear. But then you see, back in the LFC lines of communication positions, you wouldn't have guns sighted to cover any particular area. Once we'd broken through those early FDLs, which hadn't been there very long, they'd only been there probably a night or something like that, then really we had a pretty clear run and everything was there to shoot up.
Do you think that you did a lot of material damage? Or
yes, I think we did. I think so. You can't sort of say that how many trucks were destroyed or anything like that, but I don't think it did their morale any good to suddenly have somebody shooting you up in your LFC area.
I was about to say, would you say that the effect was probably more psychological than actual material, that they would be jumpy and alarmed by
yes, it could
days
be.
Afterwards?
I don't think they would. Yes, the Italians might have been. I mean, the Italians used to get jumpy and alarmed over everything, but the Germans were much more stable and less prone to panic than the Italians were. The Italians panicked all the time whenever they couldn't understand anything, you know. But the Germans were very different.
Was the enemy you were going up against mainly Italian or mainly German?
No, I think it was Germans in those forward positions because we knew they'd moved up facing the centre of them, the true defences. But I would say probably in the back areas they were a mixture of Germans and Italians. But initially I think we broke through the German FDLs and then came back through them at a later stage.
Do you remember if the journey back was rougher than the journey on the way out?
No, I think it would be about the same, I think. You know, I don't think there would be very much to choose between the two. I would have thought the Italians would have very largely disappeared from the scene by then. The Germans wouldn't have done. And if we had a rough time at all, it would have been going through those German positions right at the front again, their FTLs.
Slip trenches.
Yes, slip trenches would have been dug then, definitely.
How long was it between this raid and the order that you've got to break out of Matruh and go
break out again? Well, I think... Well, we were told to, after this breakout and return... The battalion was now ordered to move down to a rest area on the flat coastal strip to the east of Mirza Matruh. On the flat coastal strip, which means that it's below the escarpment. The battalion was deployed in box formation. There was very little cover, it was blazing hot, and the Germans put in a fairly heavy attack from Minga Kwam, which was held by the New Zealand Division. Now, it was necessary for the New Zealand Division to withdraw from Minga Kwam under pressure, and therefore it left 50 Div in a precarious position below the escarpment. So what happened was that after we'd come back in again from the breakout, we were ordered to move down below the escarpment to this rest area. But having got down there, with the New Zealanders pulling back, we were in quite an exposed position. And another breakout was planned. And this time it was to go through the German lines again and then to go 35 miles eastwards to Fuka. We knew that German tanks weren't far away and would soon be overlooking the rest area from the edge of the escarpment. That's where we'd been. And that 50 Div must climb the escarpment again before being able to break through the German screen. That was why I think it was so crazy to go down off that escarpment when they did.
But then was that, how many days do you think that was before you were?
Oh, that was practically the following day, I think.
Did this rest area have any facilities?
No, nothing like that. They just called it a rest area. That's all. It didn't have anything at all. No. I don't know why they called it a rest area, really, most extraordinary thing to call it. Yes.
So you got orders then to get organised and break up, go
yeah.
back towards Fuka. How did people feel about that? Did it disturb them that there was another retreat
yes.
being ordered?
Well, they'd already done it at Gazala, they'd broken out. They'd broken out at Mirza Mitru and come back. And now we were going to do a similar thing. Now, at this point in time, then I think a lot of people would have been saying and were saying, well, this is bloody well it, because we're not going to get away with it a second time, because this time they will be ready for us, you know, especially as the Germans had more or less disposed of the New Zealand threat, you know. And I think that people were a bit worried about what was going to happen on this one, and with justification, as you will see. But here you see we had a rather different plan. Each battalion in the division, that's all, both the Durham battalions and the 69 Brigade, with their supporting arms, were to be formed into a single column, which you can imagine was pretty long. And there, of course, this is the story of B Company.
But your battalion was two columns, wasn't it? A and B.
Yes.
Or 9 and 10, I think they were.
That's right. The battalion was in two columns. Number 9 was with B Company, commanded by the commanding officer, and number 10 with D Company, commanded by Major Sell. And the company, my company, B Company, was with number 9 column, and the company commander was was Captain Pitt.
Does this mean then that that time the battalion was down to just two rifle companies?
No, C Company had been, I think we mentioned it earlier on, had been sent somewhere to do something, and they eventually came back, I think, when we got back to almost back to Alamein, they appeared on the scene again. So at that particular time, yes, there were just two. There were two columns, one with B Company and one with D.
C was away on detachment somewhere then.
Yes, I mean we might be able to. Look, I can't. Then I think we mentioned that they had gone somewhere earlier on, didn't we?
So then, each of these columns, 9 and 10, would consist. The core would be a rifle company.
Yes, you'd have all three platoons in troop carriers, and you would have 1,500 weight trucks and that, signallers and gunners and what have you, have got to get out as well, so they would be amongst them as well.
By and troop carriers, are these the three tonners?
Three tonners, yes, that's it.
Did you get a very detailed briefing on how this was all going to be done, or was it more or less a case of just being told to do the same thing again but keep going?
Yes, I would say that's what it was. I mean, we were told we weren't going to come back. On the earlier occasion, they had said you might have to go back into Mitru, and in fact we did have to. But this time, this was a definite breakout, and we were to make for Fuka, which in fact at that time was an RAF drone, but subsequently the Germans captured Fuka, and I think one of the columns, Harry Sell's column, did what it was told to do with D Company and went to Fuka, and most of them got put in the bag. But we were warned prior to that that the Germans were there at some stage or other, so we didn't.
Was this purely a breakout operation to escape, or was it represented as being yet another aggressive drive through the enemy to disrupt them?
No, I think that this was a. I would say that this was definitely withdrawing towards the I mean, it was partly due to the fact that we were in this precarious position in the exposed rest area below the escarpment. But other than that, this was definitely a withdrawal some 35 miles eastwards towards the towards Egypt, if you like, to the neighbourhood of Fuka. It was to be another breakout on the Gazala scale, and this time the Germans would be ready and waiting for just such a move. But there was no intention of coming back to Mirza Matru. I think Mirza Matru was over and done with once the New Zealanders withdrew. And don't forget, the Germans were only, 8 miles away at Minga Kwam. They weren't very far. And with the New Zealanders having to withdraw, then we couldn't have stayed where we were. And the only way to go was in that direction, eastwards. And I would imagine that by then, somebody somewhere had decided that a stand would be made at Alamein. And I think that comes into it, as mentioned, fairly soon. So I think by that time, they had made up their minds that Mirza Matru was no longer tenable at all, and therefore this was a breakout to get out of the place and as many of us as we could back towards the delta to the east.
Did you have to leave a lot of stuff behind or destroy it on this occasion?
Well, we destroyed and left most of our stuff behind at Gazala. There's a funny story about that, because after the Alamein battle, when the battalion moved up again with the 8th Army, they went near to the Gazala positions, and Ian English went back to find a pair of desert boots that he'd left behind in Kanmi headquarters dugout in the Gazala line. And there was a great deal of laughter about this, because the Arabs had looted practically everything. The only things they hadn't taken were Ian English's boots, which stank to high heaven. They were a terrible, really decrepit old pair of boots, and everything else had gone, but there were Ian's boots, so of course he collected them again. But we left a lot of stuff behind there and destroyed a lot of stuff, because you really had to travel light. I mean, that's when things like valises went for a burden, and your spare kit and all that sort of thing. And you really were down to very little in the way of what you were wearing, And I had a pistol slung around with a single belt, which I carried, and normally I carried a rifle, but the pistol was there as well, Shirt, trousers, desert boots, steel helmet, and that was it.
What happened then on this second breakout from Matru when you were going back towards Fuka?
Well, that was by far the one where we got the heaviest casualties. That was certainly the worst one, And I think we'll have to tell the story, because it's all to do with being trapped in this wadi, which is the thing.
But the route had been wrecked, hadn't it?
Only up as far as the escarpment.
Only up to the top
of the escarpment by Julian Parker, who was the guide, in actual fact.
Was he permanently allocated that sort of duty?
Don't think so. I don't know what Julian was doing then. He subsequently became adjutant, but at that time I think he was with one of the rifle companies, and he was simply deputised to recce a route up the escarpment, which he did. Which was quite a tricky business, because the Germans were pretty near the top of it, But he did that, and he was responsible for making sure that the leading trucks went over the escarpment at that particular point. But that was as far as the recce had gone.
And the wadi was beyond the lip.
The wadi was off the escarpment, in actual fact.
Yes,
I've got it down here somewhere, I think, actually. You see, it was a fact, I think, that although the New Zealanders were holding the main thrust, German tanks were closing in from the south and would soon be overlooking the rest area from the edge of the escarpment. It was gloomy news, because with the coastal road cut, the only alternative for 50 Div was to wait until dark, then climb the escarpment and break through the German screen, afterwards sweeping east towards Fuka. Each battalion in the division with its supporting arms was to be formed into a single column, and battalion commanders were responsible for having routes reconnoitred over the escarpment. That was battalion commander's responsibility. Now, the 8th Battalion CO was still issuing his orders when the commander of an anti-tank regiment in support of the 8th Battalion drove up in his truck to the edge of the small depression where the CO was holding his conference to say that a tank attack was developing from the west. This rather startling news was confirmed almost immediately by the appearance of enemy tanks some 3,000 or 4,000 yards away towards the escarpment. The Germans, using captured honey tanks supported by 8-wheeled armoured cars, were endeavouring to come down the escarpment with the object of destroying some of the tightly packed and vulnerable maintenance vehicles of the division parked on the coastal strip. So it was really a crazy situation to be where we were. Absolutely, utterly vulnerable. And I remember this because the conference broke up immediately and the CO's parting words were, whatever happens, the Fuka outpost will be held. The company commanders hurried back to their areas, and as the riflemen could not take a very important part in the action that was to follow, they sat back and watched the battalion anti-tank guns go into action. Now, the two-pounder anti-tank guns were in charge of Lieutenant Catford, who had a troop sergeant named Buick, and they ran a couple of hundred yards to his troop of guns. These were the two-pounders. They were manhandled off their porties. Of course, they were up on the porties because they were ready for the breakout, and dragged into position on a forward slope. There was no cover of any description, but the ground was thick with camel thorn, and Captain Rickard that until the troop opened fire, the guns would be difficult to locate from a distance once the porties were out of the way. The two-pounders, sighted roughly in line with about 25 yards between each, were commanded by a corporal, a lance corporal, and another lance corporal. The fourth gun, having developed a mechanical defect during the withdrawal from the Gazala line, remained on its portie. Meanwhile, the German tanks had come down the escarpment to open fire on some of the vehicles, and for a moment it looked as though there would be a stampede of trucks. That's because they were firing into the tightly packed maintenance vehicles. Then there was a sharp crack as the first of Catford's guns opened fire at 1,300 yards, a long range for two-pounders, to be followed by the other two guns. The shooting was very accurate. Within the space of a few moments, three of the tanks were hit and burst into flames, which was pretty good at 1,300 yards. Catford's troop were using American-manufactured ammunition issued to the battalion only a few weeks previously, which had a somewhat larger charge than the ammunition normally used and gave better penetration. Two of the German armoured cars were then knocked out, by which time several South African guns had backed in position farther up the slope behind the two-pounders and had opened fire from their porties.
So these were also anti-tank guns?
They were anti-tanks as well, yeah. And then another group of German tanks in position on the escarpment to the south was firing solid shot at Catford's guns, a number of shells falling among the porties. Two more tanks were then put out of action by the combined fire of the battalion anti-tank guns and the South Africans, forcing the remainder of the enemy tanks to withdraw. It had been a most successful action with five tanks and two enemy armoured cars knocked out, with no loss to the 8th Battalion. I mean, if Catford hadn't have done that, the German tanks could have got in amongst all the vehicles parked waiting to go over the escarpment and completely rolled up the whole battalion.
Did they actually knock out any vehicles at all?
Not that I know of. It doesn't say so here, and I think it would have done if they had done.
What sort of range would you consider suitable for a two-pounder then?
Well, obviously not 1,300. I'd have thought about 800 yards or something like that. 1300 is quite a lot.
Do you remember if the German tanks were moving as they fired, or had they stopped to fire?
No, I can't remember that at all. I can remember the tanks. They were about, it says here, about 3,000 or 4,000 yards away towards the escarpment. Remember them appearing, and then I think they probably stopped because they wouldn't have come down the forward slopes of the escarpment. They wouldn't have attempted to come down because it was very, very steep, which we later found when we had to go up, and also when we'd come down to go into the rest area. So they stayed up the top, and I don't think that's probably not the best position for a tank to be firing from. So I doubt very much. It depends. I mean, Catford got over there very quickly. It was only 200 yards. He was at the CO's conference. Got the two pounders off the portees, dragged them into position and opened fire. I should have thought within about 5 minutes, something like that. But it was certainly a good effort on his part, but it also looks as though the Germans missed a golden opportunity there. I mean, if they'd have come down the escarpment, they'd have lost anything that tried to come down it, I think, because the anti-tank guns would have got them, or the 25-pounders would have got them. So could be that they were a little reluctant to commit themselves.